Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. Much like last summer, around this same time, the Real College Podcast vault of unheard content has begun to burst at the seams. It is my absolute pleasure to announce that after months of careful deliberation, we have decided yet again to open the doors of the RCP vault wide for all to hear. In this episode of Real College Podcast, we will be bringing you an assorted trail mix of segments aged to perfection with a bio of a local classical composer, followed by a profile of a local restaurant, a dive into how environmental issues and racism intersect here on campus, learn about mental blindness or aphantasia, a quick review of a hot new read, conversations with a Midwest star, and a look at what makes one Target in a Twin Cities suburb something special. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. In the first segment of the episode, we will hear from reporter Easton Smisky as she profiles a local classical composer here in the Twin Cities. Here's Easton with more.
I'll start off with C. Then I'll go up by fifths. And you can see that I've moved to different notes by the same leap every time. So then if I continue that, and then I would eventually come back to C. So it's the sense that you can like sort of travel anywhere on this like web of musical objects and they have a smooth and fun ride on the way.
That's Emily Boyajian. She is a musical composer who also happens to be my neighbor in my apartment building.
When I was probably 4 or 5, my mom taught me the first things on the piano. Beethoven was definitely my favorite composer as a kid and was the thing that got me really passionate about classical music.
Emily explained one of her favorite things about piano music and composing is the circle of fifths.
It's the idea that you can like move from one key to another in a way that still sounds very smooth and cohesive. It's like, say, maybe I play a C major chord, then an F sharp major chord, then they'll clash and it'll like sound like a big change, but then there are ways of like maybe going two other keys first, so that you can sort of transition between C major and F sharp major in a way that sounds like more smooth, and you'll barely even notice that you have moved keys until you're already there.
This isn't the only kind of transition that Emily has taken to in her life.
I just thought of myself as being a cross-dresser, and I didn't really consider transitioning since I thought that it was unfeasible, but then after I started to actually meet people who had transitioned, then I started thinking this is actually something they could do.
But Emily didn't always know she wanted to go through a gender transition. As a kid, her only knowledge about being trans came from negative stereotypes she saw in the media.
And it's only like in college and after college that I started to learn more about being transgender and issues around transgender and starting to actually meet people who had the same feelings as I did. So it was probably just like more of a learning process for me and more of a gradual path to self-acceptance.
Not everyone in her life has been as accepting as she is of herself.
The bummer is that my parents have not been supportive. They still do not approve of me being trans, but I mean, they are currently living on the East Coast where I grew up, so only really see them during the holidays, so it's like really my informal family here, people that I care about here in the Twin Cities are most important to me, and they're supportive, so I'm definitely grateful to have a community where I can be myself and be happy.
Emily says her experiences are reflective of the broader human experience that everyone goes through.
I have the same basic things I want in life. I want to be happy and like do things that are fulfilling in the short term and the long term, and I want to pursue my own passions. And I'm similar in a lot of the most basic human wants and desires that people have. I think people change no matter what, so even people who don't transition their genders will still be way different from their previous selves from a few years ago or from their childhood selves. So I feel like I've changed just in unique ways, but also in similar ways to how people change in general. People, I think, are all both connected and disconnected in our own ways, since we all come from different cultures and have different problems on the surface, but then we often have very similar underlying goals and underlying passions in our lives.
Part of what makes Dinky Town great is the variety of food selections and their proximity to one another. In this segment of the podcast, we will be hearing from reporter Quinn Van as she sits down with the owners of Dinky Town mainstay, Shuang Cheng. Here's Quinn with more.
Shuang Cheng, a beloved restaurant in the heart of Dinky Town, has become a staple of the Minneapolis dining experience. My family and I became regulars, leading me to the question, who owned this place? I'm Quinn Van, and I sat down with the owner of Shuang Cheng, Daniel Lam, to find some answers.
So, I was born in Vietnam. Growing up in Vietnam, I really love it. We have many good memories. Vietnam back then was peaceful. It was a beautiful country.
In 1955, the U.S. joined the Vietnam War.
1954, every American president has offered support to the people of South Vietnam.
Roger, that was some sort of rifle grenade. It came all the way through the building.
Lam is choked up, recalling the memories.
Our house was burned down in the middle of the warfare. During the war, you move a lot to find a place of refuge with the hopes that if it was safe, you would return home some days. I lost my mother when I was 9 years old. She was shot in the middle of the combat, so I grew up with only my father. Living under communist rule, there were not only must for me. I want an opportunity for a better future.
He decides to escape.
You left Vietnam like November 1978.
I was 18 at that time. My father was already 80 years old. He didn't want to go. That was my last time I saw him. I escaped from Vietnam in small boat that sailed to Malaysia. There were more than 100 people on a very small boat for 3 days and three nights. But many people were seasick. They could not eat or drink. People could not handle the conditions anymore. They would jump up and swim to any land they could see. They just have to get off the boat and find land. When I left, I have no idea where I would end up, but I ended up in a refugee camp in Malaysia for about 8 months.
He made it to the U.S., building a new life, facing new hardships of a refugee finding his place in a new country. I asked him what was most difficult when he first landed here.
Culture, language, it's different.
I didn't have anyone, said my younger brother. We were all alone, just trying to figure it out.
Reflecting on his early memories of Vietnam, he reflects on his decision to leave.
I'm happy here. Here I'm comfortable. I don't have to worry about the things I have to do in Vietnam.
It's more peaceful.
I asked him what he would say to the scared 18-year-old on the boat. He said this advice was more for me and other young people about to venture out into the unknown.
is work hard. Mm-hmm. And you believe on yourself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you think that's more important. You know, you trust yourself, you can do whatever you want. You don't want to know, you know, what you can do, you know, than anybody else. You trust yourself. You know, work hard and what you want. Believe on yourself, you can do it.
In the aftermath of George Floyd's murder here in the cities last summer, students on campus have been grappling with what it means to attend the University of Minnesota, as well as what we should be expecting from faculty and the Board of Regents. In this segment of the podcast, we will hear from reporter Amy Stager as she attempts to unpack what students at the Department of Forest Resources have been up to since the events transpired last May. Here is Amy with more.
If you desire peace, cultivate justice, but at the same time, cultivate the fields to produce more bread. Otherwise, there will be no peace. These words can be found on a plaque where I'm standing in front of a big bronze statue memorializing Father of the Green Revolution, recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, Dr. Norman E. Borlaug, on the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota.
I think students were fed up and we've had enough with this.
Hannah Jo King is a graduate student in the Forestry Department. Current graduate students at the Department of Forest Resources have been organizing this summer and fall to cultivate justice. In October, they went public with a letter addressed to department leadership, faculty, and staff demanding a stronger commitment to anti-racism. Other departments in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences have also sent letters. But I'm interested in why students in the Forest Resources Department felt compelled to organize to create change, why leadership has been slow to address their concerns, and why it's important for academic institutions to work toward environmental justice. There was an underwhelming response from department leadership after the murder of George Floyd in May. Most of the department leadership's response has been an email, which has not been sufficient for students. A shutdown STEM day was organized, and it energized students. Natural Resources Management already had an organized student group. King, a Black woman, wasn't involved in writing the letter, but supported her peers when they took the initiative to address the racism in the department. Although individual faculty members have reached out and shown support for the students, only one has signed the letter, out of around 400 signatures.
As a student of color, my whole life, I have not been thought by people that look like me. Honestly, I never had the expectation. When I came back to grad school, I was like, get ready for whitewashing, get ready to feel like you don't belong, but like, hey, I'm getting an education. There are so few higher institutions where you're going to find faculty who are not white.
The diversity committee has started to update their strategic plan from 2017, which is something the students asked for. This letter goes beyond diversity and inclusion and demands a broader commitment to anti-racism. That means looking at and changing policies, what teachers are teaching.
What inactions are you doing? Because your inactions allow the current structures, which are oppressive and racist, to continue.
It's also about creating a space that is comfortable for students of color. One of the demands in the letter is to replace the Green Hall mural, which is offensive. A Green Hall mural subcommittee report was put together in 2019 that includes comments from students and artists. The report recommends that the mural be replaced.
I think the mural is absolutely ridiculous. There's a depiction of, well, God, I don't even know if I want to explain it.
I had never seen the Green Hall mural, so I went to give it a look. It's in the basement hallway of Green Hall, which is long and cavernous. The mural takes up at least half the length of the wall and towers over you as you walk through. There are many human figures in it, and they're all white, except for one American Indian depicted, clutching beads and looking upon all the white men doing various things like cutting down trees and working the land. The Green Hall Mural Subcommittee report calls the mural not only a misrepresentation of history, but antithetical to the values of the Forest Resources Department.
It's this physical reminder every day that the department does not care about any students. So yeah. Frustrating.
I'm sorry. It is frustrating. I wouldn't want to be in a space like that either.
The grad students at the University of Minnesota are not alone in their frustration. Grad students all around the country have been trying to change their universities from the bottom up and have been organizing for their voices to be heard.
A university's job, if it is truly a place of knowledge, is to respond to the knowledge that's being constantly created through organizing by students, through organizing by young people.
Teju Adisa-Farrar is a geographer and writer who focuses on environmental and climate justice, specifically Black geography and how Black communities influence and are shaped by their environment.
Diversity is about numbers. You could have a place that is 50% non-white, but all of the non-white people or most of the non-white people don't have any power to make decisions. What is more important to me than diversity and inclusion is who has the power to make decisions and who has the power to affect curriculum, who has the power to affect what people are reading, who has the power to affect what students are let into the programs, who has the power to hire professors of color, who in the department feels supported to talk about the issues that are not only happening now in the case of the murder of George Floyd, but have been happening over time, especially in the context of Minnesota. There's tons of laws regarding racial segregation.
Depending on where you are, there are traces of racism.
In most of this country, in the U.S., wherever there are forests, there was lynching. It's one thing to disappoint students, but it also means that your institution is not aligned with what's happening right now. And what kind of academic institution doesn't want to be on the progressive side of history? What kind of institution is supposed to be educating the next generation of scholars, thinkers, doers, designers, architects, doesn't want to comment or respond to what's happening now?
For the department to not listen to these perspectives means that they could be losing the opportunity to create a better world.
A lot of times institutions, when they don't want to necessarily completely rethink the paradigms that they have been indoctrinated into, they put bureaucracy as a barrier.
I described the mural to her and explained the subcommittee's findings.
Art is pivotal in movements for justice. There's iconography, there's photographs, there's drawings, there's graffiti, there's painting. And in universities especially, the art that's there is supposed to tell us what's our collective history.
Without structural change, art will not have as much power to shift narratives. She quotes Nina Simone.
An artist reflects the times.
Picket lines, school boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot. But all I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me.
There is art that is antiquated, and there are artists who are coming out and saying this art does not reflect the institution, the history, or the people, that it needs to change.
Although the students' concerns are immense and expansive, there has already been evidence of change within the university and its research. King told me one of the reasons she came to the University of Minnesota is so she could be involved with a specific project.
This project exists, like that means I can find like a home at the University of Minnesota. Kawe Gada Nana Gadawan Daman Minoman. I'm not an Ojibwe language speaker, so I might have gotten that pronunciation wrong, but it translates in English to first we must consider Minoman, and Minoman or Psin is wild rice, an important grain in the Great Lakes region and a sacred grain to Ojibwe and Dakota peoples.
First we must consider Minoman is a collaborative research project.
It's also tribally driven, so the questions come from the tribal partners. Everything is analyzed collectively. We make decisions together.
We keep on saying, go slow. Yeah, that's what they say. Go slow. Well, that's just the trouble.
Mental visualization is something that many of us who can do it take for granted. Here to teach us about aphantasia or the blind mind is reporter Gracie Stockton with more.
Picture this. Bring your favorite image.
If you could only imagine.
Picture
in your
this.
Mind, I want you to imagine
you
this.
You can believe this.
It's real.
Picture this.
Picture this.
But what if you can't? I'm Gracie Stockton, and this is The Blind Mind. Let's do a little test. Close your eyes. Now, try and picture a red star. What does your star look like? Is it sharp and pointy? Super detailed? A vague black and white outline? Or is it nothing? If you're like me, you see nothing. And that lack of voluntary visualization is known as aphantasia.
My name's Rachel, and I can't picture things in my head.
Rachel has lived with it her whole life, but has only had a name for it for
about 6 months.
Rachel learned about aphantasia, link hopping, as she calls it. She stumbled upon an article that put a name to something she didn't know other people experienced too.
It's really explained a lot of the, I'm going to call them loud conversations that my husband and I have had over the years where we're trying to, you know, work on something together, and building our chicken coop is probably a prime example. To try and put something together or to try and do something, I just get in there and try and fit pieces together and do it as I'm doing it, whereas he will sit back, and I realize now he can actually work through the whole kind of construction in his head and go, okay, right, that goes there. And I'm like, how can you just do that without putting it together to see if it'll fit?
As a mother, Rachel wondered how her kids saw the world.
So, yeah, and then that kind of morphed into, well, I wonder what our boys are like. My boys are 11 and 14. So sat the older one down and I showed him the Apple scale test.
The Apple scale test is pretty simple. The task? Try to picture an apple in your head. Now, rank your image on a scale of 1 to 5. 1 being a vivid, realistic apple, and 5 being blackness. A 2 is like a cartoon or 2D apple, and a 4 is a vague outline or blurry image.
And I said, you know, if I asked you to picture an apple in your head, what would your picture look like? And he straight away pointed to the most vivid, clear, textured, detailed one. I'm like, okay, cool. That's kind of where that conversation can stop. There's no need to go on. And then sitting down with my younger son, Seth, and repeated the question with him. And he's like, there's nothing. I'm like, okay, so if you close your eyes and try to picture something, he's like, there's no picture. He says, my screen doesn't work.
So how do you learn with a broken screen? And what happens to your life if you can't fix it?
So I went on a date with this guy a while back, like pre-COVID, and my phone died, or like something happened, like it short-circuited. So I was able to call people, but I couldn't do anything else. Like I couldn't Google anything. I couldn't text anyone. I literally could only call using Siri. And we were supposed to be meeting up in a different city nearby. And I was on the highway when this happened. And so I couldn't get directions back to my house because I can't visualize where I live. I couldn't get directions to this new place, like this restaurant we were going to, because I can't visualize the city in my head to know. I don't even know if I'm going north or south on the highway right now. Like I know nothing.
Emily Clayton also has aphantasia. She's been living with that blank screen her whole life.
And so I was calling him and trying to explain to him, like, hey, I need you to give me like the most detailed directions. Like essentially I need you to pull up your maps and watch where I'm driving and tell me where to get off and where to turn. And he did not get it. He was so confused. And he's like, I don't understand why you can't just like take the 8 and get off on exit 15 and then turn left and right and left and then just be there. And I'm like, because I can't, I can't do that.
I'll admit, I'm a proud engineering dropout. I say that jokingly, but I struggle a lot with math and science in the same way, because I can't picture molecules or see how machinery functions just by closing my eyes. In college, I tried explaining it to an art history professor to ask for accommodation since I couldn't memorize images like the rest of the class. I was lucky, and my professor was really understanding, letting me use images as an aid. And it made me think, I wish I could have had the help way earlier in my schooling, too.
I think that learners in the classroom would benefit from accommodations. A lot of the times, the teachers aren't aware of every disability that there is in the world.
Emily is in grad school studying speech, language, and hearing sciences. She wants to help kids with speech and hearing disabilities to learn. And she agrees that kids with aphantasia could use some help, too.
And so a lot of teachers don't even know that it exists, right? And so they tend, and this was my experience at least, to lean on, okay, we're going to imagine an ocean and we're going to describe what you see at the ocean. And then you have this kid who's over there in the corner thinking, what on earth is she talking about? I've never been to the ocean. I can't picture an ocean in my head from a movie or TV show. And so I think that it would help to be able to have that kid on a caseload for the teacher to be able to understand, hey, they can't visualize anything. Let me print off a picture and give it to them before the activity starts.
Research about aphantasia is relatively new and limited, but it's pretty clear that it has a major effect on learning. Rachel only found out about aphantasia recently, so helping her son, Seth, was impossible up until now.
But there is a part of me that's like, oh my God, how, you know, I've let him struggle for, you know, all of his 6 years of primary school with this. How did I not know? But at the same time, it's like, well, I didn't know this was a thing. So it's a real dichotomy there of, you know, I should have done better, but now I can help him with things that I've picked up along the way that work for me anyway. And it actually sparked, I'm on good terms with his teacher anyway, but I ran into her at the shops a couple of days after that conversation with my son and kind of said to her, do you have a minute? You know, I'd like to talk to you about something. She said, yeah. And when I started explaining about it and saying, I've had this conversation with him and he can't picture things in his head. And she went, that actually explains so much about why certain things he can remember just complete clarity, and yet others he's got no idea. So that was a really good conversation to have, not only with him, but also with his teacher.
Aphantasia has a big effect on lots of little things in my life, but the hardest part is people not believing that this is my reality.
What does it feel like when people don't believe you?
I mean, I totally get it. Like, it sounds crazy. It sounds made up.
We also struggle a lot with remembering faces.
I think that it's hard for people to understand that it's not just because I'm rude or I don't care. It's just that I can't remember what you look like.
Both in real life and on TV.
I struggle a lot with keeping up with characters, especially on shows like The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, where like they all look so similar to me. And it'll be like the finale, and I'm like, literally, I don't know who these people are. When I'm with
you, that's what makes sense. Here to give you the lowdown in less than a minute on a hot new book that features a diverse trail mix of stories is reporter Emma Morris with more.
Finding out author John Green released a new book brought me back to when his hit novel, The Fault in Our Stars, could be found on almost anyone's bookshelf. As someone who has read all of his books, I was excited to hear about this new one, and even more so because it's his first nonfiction book. The Anthropocene Reviewed, Essays on a Human-Centered Planet, is full of essays on the human experience and will have you happy and laughing one moment and nearly in tears the next. Some of my personal favorite essays are Canada Geese, The Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest, and The Notes App. Green explains these things and their meaning in his life and says the things that we have needed to hear and have conversations about. I loved this book. It was refreshing and a lovely change from the typical fiction writing that he frequently does. For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris. I turn my back, you were gone in a flash like you are.
That is Lizzie on her song When I'm Alone, which easily defined most of us for the past year during the COVID-19 pandemic when we were forced to endure lockdowns and go for long periods of time without intimate social contact. Last fall, during the height of the nationwide lockdown, I sat down to talk with Lizzie virtually about how her Midwest upbringing has impacted her music, how she's been coping with isolation during COVID, her creative process, and starting a popcorn company. Although some considerable time has passed since me and Lizzie spoke, it feels like only yesterday. Anyway, here's Lizzie.
Hi there, I am Lizzie. I'm a singer, songwriter, musician, play guitar, write songs, and love to perform. So I grew up in the Quad Cities, which is like an Iowa, Illinois area right there on the Mississippi River. So I, you know, probably drove over that river nearly every day. And I got out of the Midwest when I was 18 and thought like I'd never come back. But as I went out into the world and got to live lots of cool places and see lots of cool things, I really, really missed the Midwest, and it always felt like home when I come back. And I think even like the Mississippi River, as I would travel and, you know, be talking to people even in other countries, you know, the Mississippi River is like kind of, you know, iconic. It's like kind of almost mythological or something, you know, it's very symbolic.
Lizzie reflected on her own musical style and how her Midwest upbringing has impacted her art.
I think there's kind of like a straightforwardness to my music and to my you know, style. I'm kind of a no-frills kind of person. I don't know if that's a Midwestern trait, but, you know, I try to stay humble, and you know, I really appreciate my family, and I don't know. I think it's more for other people to tell me how they see it play out. But I'm super happy to be living back in the Midwest now.
Lizzie told me about her hopes for this summer and what she wanted to accomplish during her time at home.
I am gonna start trying to do a little writing for a new album. And then I would ideally start touring again. I have some shows booked for summer, but ideally I'd be making a record and playing some shows.
Her hopes for a summer tour have in fact come true, with back-to-back appearances here in the cities this fall. Lizzie will be performing Friday, September 10th at the Parkway Theater in Minneapolis, and again the following Saturday, September 11th. Lizzie went on to tell me about her plans for the future and how fans can stay in touch.
People want to follow me on Instagram. That's my main jam, is Lissy Music. That's Lissie Music. I'm going to be putting out an EP of cover songs. I do a lot of covers, have over the years. So that's something kind of new to share that's coming your way. And then otherwise, like, not a lot going on. I'm taking a master gardener course, and I'm starting a popcorn company with a friend, and what else do I want you to know? I am trying to raise money for Democratic House and Senate state seats in Iowa currently. I love to garden and, like, plant trees. I live on a farm, so I'm really trying to make the most of this time to, like, tend to the earth. But career-wise, just probably put an album out sometime next year. You know, I do live streams that I'll continue to do, you know, but then when things open back up, you know, I'm going to be up in the Twin Cities playing concerts, so I'll look forward to it.
We are looking forward to it, too. In addition to touring and working on new music, Lizzie mentioned that she also started a popcorn company, so I couldn't let her leave without telling me more.
A friend of mine, Diane Whaley, who actually was one of the co-founders of Seed Savers Exchange, we're friends down here in Northeast Iowa. We've been talking one day, and, you know, I've got like a 50-acre farm. Only about 10 of them are really, like, tillable. And so I just make hay. That being said, I was like, oh, maybe someday I can, like, grow popcorn. We can start a popcorn company, because I had this idea to call it Indie Pop. And then the flavors would be, like, dream pop and, like, folk pop and K-pop and country pop. And you could have, like, this music genre-flavored popcorn line. And so then my friend Diane was like, I have the most amazing caramel corn recipe. I've always wanted to start a popcorn company, too. And this was, like, in May, in the middle of the pandemic. And we're just like, why don't, like, let's just do it. Like, why don't we do it? So we got, like, an LLC, and we found the corn that we wanted to use. And I developed a savory flavor called Folk Pop, and she's got her caramel corn called Dream Pop. And it's called Ops Pops, Indie Pop. So it's kind of hard to say. But we have, like, the cutest logo a local artist made for us. And we're having a little social distance party where we'll just, like, give it away to our friends to just kind of, like, just trying to find things, you know, we say add a little pop of joy into your life. But I think it was something nice for her and I to do, because the world is so heavy. It's like, you know, caramel corn makes people happy.
Since me and Lizzie spoke, her popcorn brainchild has blossomed into a beautiful popcorn person. Ott's Pops Indie Pop currently has both Dream Pop Caramel Corn as well as Folk Pop Savory Corns listed for sale on their website. However, they are unfortunately sold out at the moment. Hopefully, as we move towards fall and the Iowa corn turns to harvest, there will be more savory and sweet treats in stock at OttsPops.com. That is OttsPops.com. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.
I'm gonna break down the walls to keep us from getting along. I'm gonna figure out.
Target, a college student's best friend, has all of the essentials and more at ridiculously low prices. It seems that no matter whom you talk to, the only difference is which Target they shop at, not if they shop there. In the final segment of the episode, we will hear from reporter Rachel Mills as she takes us on a journey to one extra special suburban Target where an interesting persona resides. Here's Rachel with more.
Imagine for a moment you walk through the sliding glass doors into Target. To your right, you see the checkout lanes, and past that home decor. And then to your left, you see the deli and the bakery, followed by 22 aisles of groceries. You grab a basket from the stack in front of you, and then you hear him.
Hey, Sue. Woo! And how are you doing today? Hey, big dog. Do you guys have any questions or any of that stuff?
He's in the bakery wearing a ridiculous chef's hat, like the one from Ratatouille. And you think to yourself, it is 8 a.m. What is this guy on?
You're so silly.
His name is Michael Cashman, and he's the manager of the bakery and deli at the Maple Grove Target. I often find myself going back to him when I need a quick or interesting soundbite for a story. I know that no matter what time of day it is or what's going on in the world, Mike never fails to deliver exciting material.
All right, back to our regularly scheduled program here.
I sat down with Mike at his home just a few minutes from the Target to try to understand what it is about this man that makes him so charming. How does he do it? Mike, who is 56 years old, was drinking a glass of chocolate milk.
I just want to know what's with the jersey. Are you a Jets fan?
Oh, you know, sadly, I am a Jets fan.
When it comes to Target, Mike has seen it all.
So I've done just about almost everything in the store. I like teaching and training people. And sometimes I think people get mad at me because most people would say I talk all day.
This is true. Nearly every time I'm in the store, Mike is talking to a different guest.
How are you guys doing tonight? Good. You have any questions or anything? Good, good deal. Mr. Mitchell, how are you doing tonight?
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing so good.
But the weirdest thing is that Mike doesn't even know half their names. While I was with him in the store, a man pushed a cart up to the bakery counter and said hi to Mike. And he responded with a loud, "Hey, man." And you would have thought that they'd been pals their whole lives, but it turns out that wasn't the case.
The guy I was just talking to, I have no idea his name. But I talk to him all the time. I know. And I talk to him all the time. I know. But he always is like...
It looks like his name would be like Matt.
It's just never an introduction. It's just people that like we just start talking and that's what happens.
Mike's coworkers often get frustrated when he spends time catching up with the guests who come in to talk to him.
But I think in the end, I don't think they'd want a different boss. They think that I'm crazy sometimes. Crazy, not crazy like call the police, but crazy like crazy fun. Because I would be the person that walks into an elevator and people are in there and I would just go, "How's everybody doing?" And they would move to the back of the elevator as fast as I could.
I have never doubted anything less in my life.
I'm really loud. I'm not afraid to make weird noises or voices. I don't even know what comes out. It happens. Like I said, people think I'm weird because I will do stuff to try to make people forget what might be bugging them.
It's clear that Mike's goal is to make people's day better, and he often sets himself behind trying to put others ahead. There was a point in the conversation where the mood kind of shifted.
I guess that told me all these things that were going on with him recently and how he's struggling. And I talked to him and his wife for probably a half an hour, right in the middle of the sales floor. I know my team's going like, God, he's just over there talking. But, and then his wife came in a couple weeks ago and said that he had committed suicide. And, yeah, so that was really hard and shocking because I just had talked to him like that Wednesday before. They had a memorial that was open for everybody, and I went to that. It's just hard when they tell you the tough stuff. And you just try to be there for them.
I asked Mike why people come in to tell him, a stranger, all of these deep personal details.
You'd have to ask them that. I don't know. I'm just a person that, you know, is a manager in a freaking Target store.
It's clear Mike really cares about these people, but you have to wonder if that takes a toll on him.
I think the pressure gets to you that you always feel like you have to be that person. And so there is darkness in that. That's the way I feel.
Mike isn't as open as some of these guests.
But where they're willing to share, I'm not willing to share nothing. So don't ask me to do another interview.
Noted.
But I think people just need to say hi in the elevator and not feel like everything's weird about that.
You guys have a good weekend at all?
That's all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.